I always think people don't give each other enough of the benefit of the doubt. You know, I think most people want to do well, and they tell you that they care about you and that they love you, but they won't even give you the benefit of the doubt. I find that in veganism, it's always that way, right? They're like ascribing you the morals of like of some imaginary character. Oh, well, you're only vegan because you're part of the elite agenda to depopulate the earth. It's interesting. Like, give each other the benefit of the doubt. Most people are trying to be good out there. Most people are. If you're with me, go ahead and hit the like button, subscribe, share this. If you're on Twitter, retweet it. If you're on Twitch, do whatever Twitch users do. I don't know. I love my one Twitch user that watches every day. And I from the bottom of my heart, I'm not really sure how to thank you. But this is the Vegan with Sky show. I'm Sky Jack Morgan. Today we have Benny Malone on. And it's going to be, I think it'll be a fun time. Let's see what happens. It's the Vegan with Sky show. Sorry, Vegan with Sky. Sky Jack Morgan, thank you so much for joining us. Hey, it's Tuesday. Can you believe it? It is already October 4th. It's Tuesday, as they say in England. It's Tuesday, isn't it? It's Tuesday, isn't it? That's what we like to say, that it's Tuesday. So on Tuesday, I generally will go eat Chipotle at this artist's studio gallery. Hassan, you probably know him. He's an artist for peace. I mentioned him on the show before. I do NFTs for him. And I help him out. We're working on this cool mosaic thing at the moment. Hopefully it'll be cool. You never know with art. You never know how cool it's going to be. Anyway, so So it's Chipotle Tuesday for me in California. It's very much a tradition. Taco Tuesday is the tradition in California. What's your Tuesday, tradition where you are? What's your Tuesday tradition? Do you celebrate Taco Tuesday like we do here in Southern California, where it's an overcast day, but I still think it's beautiful. It's overcast, but it's still gorgeous, still beautiful. You know, Benny Malone's coming on, and I want to, I was reading his book last night, going over some of his points. I haven't read the whole thing, but because I kind of skip around, I'm bad. But anyway, I was reading the first chapter, which is about thought terminating cliches, and it's one of my favorites. It's one of my favorite things, this idea of a thought terminating cliche, because there, nothing can be more frustrating. He goes into, like, in other parts of his book, because every time he mentions something on the show, I'll go to the book and I'll try to like look it up and read about it, but the thought terminating cliche is like the worst one, because like I occupy a space where I enjoy thought. I enjoy thinking about things. I enjoy finding out that I might be wrong. If I come across an opinion or a point of view that is opposite my own, I think, how did you arrive at that opinion or point of view? I'd like to know more about that. Please, let's talk about it. Let's find out where you got this, what information led you to this strange point of view, strange to my brain anyway, one that I don't know where you got it, right? I want to know. I want to occupy your space and figure out why are you thinking that way. And I think sometimes you get to where you're like, you find out people who are in relationship will be like, well, it's just the way it is, or it's just who I am. You know, the worst is, it is what it is. That's the one that I fucking hate the most. I hate it is what it is. It's just like such a, just means nothing. Like I just, it is what it is. It's like Seinfeld does a bit about it, like, oh, job's a job until you know what, you know who, you know what, if we, you know. It's just, it is what it is. Oh, well, I guess we're not changing it. It is what it is. The ice caps are melting. It is what it is. I don't think Benny mentions this one in the book, but it is what it is my pet peeve. I hate it. My bête noire. When people will say things like, it is what it is. But the other thing, you know, like, you'll never, well, to each his own. And you're like, no, not to each his own. Live and let live, Sky. You know, that's like your opinion. Everyone's entitled to their opinion. Yeah, everyone's entitled to their opinion. Yeah, everyone's entitled to their opinion. That doesn't mean that all opinions are valid. And therefore, I'd like to explore the validity of your opinion and why you've arrived at it in such a... In what fashion did you arrive at this opinion? And how does it complement or negate mine? Anyway, because my opinion is that it's not right to slit the throats of animals, that we've been socialized differently. At a young age, you're socialized that everything is paradise, that animals and human beings are friends, that we are just we're just hanging out with them. The hungry caterpillar crawls along and eats the leaves, right? We always love animals until we're about 5 or 6, and at that point we're like, nope, now it's time to learn. Along with, I mean, is it 5 or 6? How old are you when you decide that you're not, when your parents decide that you're not going to treat animals like friends? When your parents decide that they're going to teach you that animals should be hung upside down and let their blood drain out of them? How old are you when that's okay? I think it's about the same age as when you find out Santa Claus is not real. I think in the Western world anyway, I think that's probably the age. What is that, 6? I think it's 6. I don't know. 5? We doing Taco Tuesday too, says Laura Griffiths in the house, all the way from good old jolly old England. You do Taco Tuesday there? That's pretty cool. But it's Tuesday, isn't it? Is it Taco Tuesday? Tuesday. Very cool vegan tacos in local vegan restaurants. Everyone loves the cool vegan tacos in local vegan restaurants. There's a vegan restaurant. We don't have a taco. There is a taco place that's all vegan. It's called Moss Veggies. It's not very good, but people like it, and it's got a couple good things. I don't know. It's not for me. Benny's book is a must read for vegans, in my humble opinion. I think that he would agree. I think that Benny would agree on that. It is quite good. I'm enjoying it. It has 4.5 stars. Let's get him out here. This 4.5 star. 4.75 star, actually. It's 4.75 star on Amazon. How to Argue with Vegans, author, the one and only, all the way from, I can never pronounce the town he lives in, upon something Nell. He's from Nellysford. He's from England, and he's going to tell us about critical concepts today after I ask him a simple question about lions. Because lions, though. All right, guys, here we go. Are you guys ready for Benny? Benny! Hey, Benny and the Jets, how you doing, sir?
Hello, Sky.
Hey, okay? Man. I can hear you absolutely fantastic. It sounds like you're right next door to me, but you're not. You're in what is the name of your town again?
I'm in Ellesmereport.
Ellesmereport. Thank you. Ellesmereport. I'll write it down so I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
The Ells.
It's a beautiful small village between Liverpool and Chester.
Liverpool and Chester. Ellesmereport.
On the Wirral Peninsula.
On the Wirral Peninsula. Yeah, see, this is the thing. everything in, like, I consider that kind of like the Lord of the Ringsy part of England, mm-hmm. where they're kind of, everything's got, you might as well live in the Shire. That's what I'm saying.
It's actually in Cheshire. Cheshire is the county. Yeah.
Cheshire. Cheshire, but the town is Chester?
Yeah, that's the county city. Suppose you'd say county town, or maybe, you know,
Cheshire.
Yeah, so Cheshire, like the county of Chester, that means really. Oh. Chester's an old Roman town, you know, the Romans founded it.
Camp. Yeah.
Yeah, it's called Dever, which, yeah. So then all them other places called Manchester, Lancaster is the same as Caster, is the same as Chester. So anywhere with that suffix, is it, you know, Chester or Caster? Was probably a Roman, well, you know, was a Roman camp. So Manchester,
it was a Roman camp, right? Just turned into a town, right? Yeah, I knew that part. The camp, the camp Manchester would be like the man camp, the camp for men, or something like that. I'm not sure what the man came from, but yes, something along those lines. I like the idea of the Cheshire Cat too. Mm-hmm. Do you guys? I'm not sure why. What was his name? C.S. Lewis? Was that C.S. Lewis?
Lewis Carroll.
Lewis Carroll. Sorry. Yeah. Whoa, I get those mixed up sometimes. Lewis Carroll, not C.S. Lewis. Lewis Carroll. He did. I don't know where he got the idea of a Cheshire Cat. Why is a Cheshire Cat got the big smile?
I think he did live in Cheshire for a bit, but he's also got connections to Llandudno, which is in Wales. That's a seaside resort. There's a lot of statues there with like the Cheshire Cat and
oh really
Alice and everything. Yeah, but I need to look it up more, but I know there is a small church in Cheshire with some connection to him.
Yeah, if
maybe
I lived in
if
I lived in Cheshire, I would have learned a little bit about the cats or about Lewis Carroll, the famous pornographer, child pornographer. When I was a kid, when I was in college, so Lewis Carroll famously had this child pornography bend that he would he had a book with it seems almost quaint by our standards. Like it's definitely like it's photography of children, but it's not like. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was in the library at Berkeley, and the book would disappear too often, and there aren't that many copies of it, and so they had to like. There's one of the few books where like you had to have a person watch you look at it and stuff. And meanwhile, it's a library full of very very expensive books that you can take home with you and read, but that book was just one of the ones that like you had to, if you wanted to go see it, you had to make an appointment, had to have someone watch you read it, look at it. There's not much reading going on with that Lewis Carroll book. It's all Jabberwocky to me. So did you little Lewis Carroll joke? What are you gonna do? Why is a lion on the cover of your book?
Oh, well, it's just a bit of a jab at the lions though argument.
Okay, I thought so.
So yeah, and I think at least one of those reviews knocking my average review score down mistook the book for actually being a collection of arguments against vegans.
so you would have a level five.
Yeah. So it's completely, they were saying it's a deceptive title, you know.
Yeah,
and
a little bit.
So, well, it's Richard Watts, who is vegan sidekick, designed the cover. I asked him if he would help me design the cover. So it's his artwork. Uh-huh. You know, everyone loves vegan sidekick, and I use some of his arguments in the book as well.
Vegan Sidekick, that's his artwork. Vegan Sidekick, I know, is like the guy who draws the little stick figures. I had no idea he was an actual...
Oh, yeah.
He could actually draw.
So, So he does stick figures, but then when he decides to, he can draw like manga style really well as well. Mm. You know, he's really good.
And, which is where the lion knocker comes from.
Yeah, so it's a door knocker. And also that's a bit of a Circle of Life reference. With the circle, it's probably a bit obscure, but yeah, just trying to get a few references to the arguments on the cover.
Circle of Life.
Also, so people could do that as well, you know.
That's
which didn't really take off.
No, it didn't take off.
Everyone who buys the book has to do that and post themselves.
Yes.
On social
media.
Well,
I can't do it.
With the hashtag.
I can't do it with my. With my copy is on the phone,
well,
so I can't. I can't do it with my. Wait, let me see. Oh crap! Let me see if I can. How do I get back to the cover? Here we go. Oh no! See, it immediately goes to text. I can't. I highlighted the veganism is the effort. The intent with personal choice and such like arguments is to take morality off the table. Veganism is the effort to put it on the table. I like that too, because it's got, you know, table. And I think about it a lot when I did my video about Gandhi choosing salt to be the thing that we're all going to be talking about when it comes to liberating the people of India. He wanted salt, not the cost of, not the tax on property or whatever. He wanted salt because it's on everyone's table. It's a staple of life. You need it. So I like this idea of veganism putting morality on the table, because, you know, a lot of what we talk about is what we eat.
Bit of a pun there as well, you know, and I think I'd do another one saying it's table talk, you know, which was,
yeah,
I think that's like a Arabic expression or maybe Persian, you know, where you have this table talk where it's like philosophical discussion is the table talk. So I've included that as well. Another obscure reference that most people probably won't.
Well, people should be.
A lot of it's for my own personal enjoyment, you know.
It's always interesting to me because if you meet someone from Iran, they talk politics every time. Like table talk, it's true. Like they will, if you go to someone's house and they're Persian or Iranian, they expect you to talk politics. They're as bad as the Greeks. Yeah. Like they need to talk. They need to be talking politics at all times. There's no like, oh, you're at a bar. Let's not talk about religion and politics. Nope. They talk about any chance they get. And yet,
I think a dinner party rule is, you know, let's not discuss politics.
Yeah.
Let's not discuss Iran. Religion. And then a vegan turns up, you know, it's even worse.
Now it's really, let's not talk about this.
No one wants to talk about it. You know, well, I suppose vegans don't even want to talk about it at the time, really. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, it's very uncomfortable.
I've definitely. I've gone through phases where I don't want to talk about it, where, you know, you talk about thought terminating cliches. Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like we aren't armed with those. We don't have them. So we have things like health reasons, you know, like that's a thought terminating cliche for us where it's clear that we don't want to talk about our veganism. When I say something about health, it's usually because I don't want to talk about it with you because you're a right wing nut job. That's usually what's. Yeah, you're a right-wing Trump supporter. I don't want to talk about veganism with you. I did it for health reasons. Now shut up. That's usually...
Yeah. Yeah, I'm plant-based for health. There you go. That's it.
Right. Yeah, you know, fine. Yeah. Let's not... like. And it does seem like Peter denying Christ as the rooster crows, but but there's no Christ, and the animals don't care that I'm not talking to this Trump supporter about animal rights.
Sometimes you just have to cut your losses and make that... judgment call. Is it going to go anywhere, this conversation? Maybe even after a few back and forths, you know, is it going anywhere? Are they going to get it? You know, maybe leading to the next person.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you know, there's lots of, you know, there's been arguments on other people's channels about whether or not you could be a right wing vegan. And I think it's an interesting conversation, an interesting question. But at the same time, if you are like that far right, if you're like your diehard Truss, you love her. She's just Truss is the best. And no other prime minister has been as good as Truss since Winston Churchill or something, you know, something ridiculous. And you're like, all right, you're not going to listen to my vegan. I don't need to talk with you about this.
Yeah, I just think that collection of values that you've probably got, it doesn't really coincide with the current Conservative government for me, because they're just introducing £18 billion worth of cuts to public services. And, you know, so on the one side, you've got this set of values to do with other animals, but then you don't care about what's happening to humans. It just doesn't align as a totality for me. You know, conceivably, okay, yeah, you could be vegan. I'm not going to say you're not vegan if you're conservative, maybe, you know. But for me, it just doesn't gel well together with that kind of values. And I think, as Rogers said, you know, the values themselves are kind of progressive anyway. So I don't know why you would just make that exception for humans.
Yeah, it's interesting because the compassion part, you'd think would, like, the people who used to have the market cornered on compassion were the religious, and religion and the right often go together, and yet they're further and further. I couldn't imagine two things further apart now. The idea of like conservative compassion, I don't believe that there's such thing as compassionate conservatism anymore. Maybe in some circles there is. But I don't see it in anywhere I've been. Like, I don't see compassionate conservatism in a way that I could think would be conducive to veganism. Not nowhere near. Like,
no, it's got a lot more extreme with this current iteration as well. Because even the kind of old conservatives, kind of like Kenneth Clark, Michael Heseltine, all them, I think they're a bit aghast at what's happening as well. You know, they're kind of. They call them the Tory grandees here. And I've got more respect for them than the current crop of conservatives, you know.
Well, let me ask you this, actually, because I was concerned with something I heard on Friday on Bill Maher's show, where he was talking with two – it was one of those shows he didn't have a conservative on. He usually has a conservative mm-hmm. on the panel. Like, he had Piers Morgan on. It was really rough. Mm-hmm. And but he had two conservatives on two liberals on, or lefties. And he said, well – every time he talks to a conservative, Granby, is that what you called them?
Yeah, a Grandy.
Grandy.
With two E's on the end, yeah.
Like a granddad or grandma.
Yeah.
So when he talks to conservative grandies who are aghast at what's going on, mm-hmm. they'll say behind closed doors when no one's watching and mm-hmm. the mics aren't hot, they'll say, hey, you're making a huge mistake thinking that I like Donald Trump. That's not the case. Mm-hmm. I don't like Donald Trump at all. I just hate liberals. I hate Democrats. And to me, that's how Hitler came to power, was this idea of no real ideas. We just hate, mm-hmm. it's just a violent response to liberalism, liberal ideals. Mm-hmm. Like, we just don't like that shit. Like, we don't have our own idea. We don't have our own ideas. We can't be bothered with that. Mm-hmm. We just don't like that shit right there. And do you find that with the Truss crowd and what's happening with like neoconservatism in the UK, that it's similar? That is there that sentiment that we just hate Labour?
Definitely the commentary around it is this culture war at the moment. It's anti-woke, anti-progressive. So everything gets interpreted through this, you know, you're a communist, you're a socialist. Yeah. Even the most slightly left of center policies that would just be, you know, quite normal in Nordic countries, say, you know, just about the NHS. I think they're just trying to sell off the NHS at the moment. That's why they've kind of wrecked the pound, you know, might be back up a bit at the moment, but it's the kind of, you know, yeah.
Well, such as the wrecked pound, it's the strong dollar too, isn't it? The dollar is stupidly strong right now. It's hurting all of us. Anyone who's holding a different type of currency, it hurts us all when the dollar is that strong. It's, it's interesting. Like, I was watching the James Whale thing with Tim, what's his name? Tim from Animal Rebellion. And you saw that, and he's like, you stupid, and you say stupid, and he's, you know, it gets to the point where they're, I don't know, I don't see much value in any of that, but maybe James Will
that has guy, I don't think we had shock jocks, really, but then in the 90s, they kind of imported them, or that idea, you know, from America.
Well, that's when they took off here, the shock jock, that's when they took off here, like,
right,
the morning zoo crew.
Yeah. So we had this thing called talk radio.
Yeah.
And it was just conversations in the beginning.
Yeah.
And it would have some good shows on, you know, just about current affairs. Then it became talk sport, and they kept the kind of, you know, became quite right wing, really. But they kept some conversational shows. But then now you've got LBC, different radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
And it tends to be, it is all this kind of anti-woke thing. So anything just gets interpreted as, you know, you're in this culture war, whatever you're asking for, or whatever claims you're making, oh, you're woke and you're...
That's what James Wales, like, you wokey, jokey, smoky, like he makes like a... he says, you're all stupid, you jokey, wokey bastards. I don't know, it's very... it's cringy. I can't even... It's difficult for me to watch because of just like a 72-year-old man shouting at a younger person. It just, that's the other part. Like, it doesn't that seem like almost hackneyed, almost so just an old, that's a cliche, right? The 72-year-old man shouting at the 35-year-old man or 40-year-old man who has mildly different ideas about, and I don't think the differences are that wildly apart. Like, I just really do believe that it's, hey, there's a problem, I'd like to solve it. It's almost to your like different, your distancing part in your book, where it's like, if you denigrate someone, you call them so, you're all just so stupid, you wokey jokies, it makes it seem like their ideas are whack, but you're not presenting any ideas for yourself. You're just saying that I'm an environmentalist. Okay, what are you doing about it?
Yeah. I think that's a poison in the well. That would be, you know, straight off. So you're introducing the person you're going to be interviewing as an extremist straight from the bat, you know, and before they even come on and before you've even heard what their views are. So any environmentalist or vegan or anything like that will be introduced by these people as extreme, you know, far left, kind of woke, whatever. And it immediately poisons opinion against them. You know, whereas what they're saying could be quite reasonable. You know, let's not pollute our environment. Let's not pour sewage into the ocean. Let's not cut all the red tape so that companies can just do whatever they want, you know. But that's seen as wacky by these people, you know.
Well, I think that's why the erosion of, I mean, again, I hate the whole, bringing up the H word, but that is how that happened, right? It's this, it's this response, it's not the new presentation of ideas. It's the response to the ideas that are existing. Mm. And it's what I hate about it, really. It's what I hate about fascism and Nazism and these types of isms, that part of those isms, is that they don't really give you any, there's nothing to think about. It's just, they suck. Let's own the libs. They suck. And it's just, okay, well, great. They suck. I agree. They suck. Now, what's your idea? Mm-hmm. Crickets. And that's just, because the only idea they might have is that cut the taxes to the rich so that it can trickle down to all of us. But that's, we've already seen that. We tried that. It doesn't work.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. It's become about owning the libs, you know, so even no matter how bad that policy is, and it's almost about, oh, this is going to get the bad reaction. And look how it's winding up the libs, you know, with our outrageous policies, you know. They're cutting public services and, you know, people are going to die. But they make it about owning the libs and...
Well, that does it. Are the libs doing themselves any favors? Like I'm a big supporter of the pronouns. You guys want to, like, anybody who wants to use the right pronouns for themselves, I'm a big supporter. I will try my hardest to use the right pronouns and all the rest. But are the libs doing themselves any favors by, you know, they're cutting public services and we're literally arguing amongst ourselves whether or not in childhood sports, a boy can play on the girls' team or a girl can play on the boys' team. That's the big argument that we're having within ourselves. And it seems, are we doing ourselves any favor by having those arguments right now? Like,
we're too much focus on it. I don't think so. And the thing is, the opponents, you know, they make a lot of hay out of that stance. That's where they want the focus to be. So with veganism, I will always look like, where do they want the argument to be as well? And they want it to be in grey areas or areas of absolute necessity, that type of thing, where, you know, where they think we're on shakier ground, basically. And they want to avoid the, what I say is the more black and white areas, you know, where there's definite certainty of sentience, where there's certainty that animals are being exploited and commodified, but they want to avoid those areas and just talk about the kind of marginal cases and that type of thing.
Right. They want to talk about oysters.
You can discuss those things, but to absolutely concentrate on them for too long and devote a lot of energy to them is a bit too distracting, I think. But that's where they want the arguments to be. So for me, that's a good sign, you know, not to argue there too much in itself, because that's where they want it.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Look at where the ranchers want to argue.
Right. The ranchers want to argue about
there and take them out of the area they want to argue on, you know. Yeah.
Because they want to talk about crop deaths or...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting because, like, with crop deaths, for example, or oysters, I'll say, well, go vegan and we'll talk about that. Like, those, that's always... And I guess I get called out a little bit because I'm a little bit of like a, well, then I'm just inside the vegan eco chamber. But I want to have those conversations actually about crop deaths, and I want to have those conversations about oysters, but I want to have those conversations with people who actually give a shit, not Piers Morgan bringing up avocados and bees when he doesn't actually give a shit about either. Like,
no, exactly. Yeah.
Like, if I had a conversation with you about whether or not oysters were sentient, I have the relative expectation. I have faith that you at least kind of give a shit about the truth of the matter, right? Whether or not oysters are sentient. I don't believe that for one millisecond when it comes to people like, you know, who non-vegans. I don't trust non-vegans when it comes to those things. You want to talk about black and white issues, right? Like, is exploiting the reproductive organs of females good or bad? Like, that should be the where we talk about these things with the.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of conversations kind of within veganism, but when they're coming from anti-vegans, it's totally different, really. Yeah,
right. When it's coming from anti-vegans, I can't even like.
Yeah. You're not even avoiding exploiting pigs. And that type of thing. Right. So, you know, yeah. So
you're not avoiding the clearly the obvious. Like, yeah. To me, it's like, it's kind of like, I brought this up on somebody else's stream. Like, oh, they were talking about vegan Gaines, his wife in like, she, like, I don't know, like her, something happened where her relative died and all, this was going on. There were all these circumstances and she like bought dog food that wasn't vegan for her dog. And people were like, well, she acted like this guy Vince was like, well, she was acting like a Nazi at that point. And it's like, all right, well, there's these other circumstances. And yes, it was wrong, but it's not ongoing. And my argument would be like, okay, well, you can date a soldier, but if you're dating someone who's literally killing someone in the streets, like, that's not a good idea. Like, you know, someone who went to war and came back, like, that's a lot different than someone who's murdering someone in the street, right? Like, that's the difference.
Yeah, people pretend not to know the difference between the kind of intentional and unintentional killing and that type of thing as well, you know.
Oh, that or the killing out of necessity, like you were saying, like well, if a bear attacked you, that kind of shit. You're just gonna let there and die? Like, no, it's not exactly what we're talking about. Speaking of those gray areas, we also have the tech company petition that we're still doing. Please go on to our change.org. What animal products are in our devices and what is being done to remove them? Who is in your phone? We're doing that. We're actually doing something about it. Whereas the people who are saying, well, there's collagen in your phone or whatever they say, they're not doing shit about it, are they? What's the critical concept theory today? What's the critical concept of our critical concept corner?
We were going to go through the different ethical theories.
Yes.
So it might be a bit of a whistle stop tour, you know, but I'll try and go through as many as possible. Yeah. So,
okay. Roll my sleeves for this.
This is just going to be, normative ethical theories, which is how we ought to act. Is because you have metaethics, which goes kind of before that about what is morality itself. So we're not concerned with that at the moment. But I did find a good website where we could possibly do an interactive episode where everyone could go through this kind of questionnaire and find out what your meta-ethical position is. So I might do that next week.
Meta-ethical position.
A pen and a pad ready, and we can go through and find out whether you're a quasi-realist or a moral realist and all.
I like that. That's a good teaser. Yeah. That's a good teaser there, Benny. We can be like, okay, well, next week, guys, tune in where we will discuss the meta-ethical positions of our listeners. What will you be? Bring a pad and pencil. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Cool, let's do it.
I'm going to start with utilitarianism anyway. And I think I was saying, you know, I do think utilitarianism is good in terms of its egalitarianism. So it tries to treat all sentient beings as, you know, taking their interests into account equally, no matter what species they are, or indeed if they, you know, it could be artificial intelligence, if it was
egalitarianism. Sorry, I thought there was a pause where I could jump in and say something about egalitarianism.
Okay. Or, you know,
egalitarianism. Is it totally equal, though? Yeah. Egalitarianism is like all negative rights are equal. Am I right about that? Like, we're not giving chimpanzees the right to vote.
Yeah, it's relevant rights. So utilitarian would say, you know, it's relevant interests when you look at that being what possible interests could they have. And then that possible interest should give an equal weight to, you know, say the equal relevant interest of a human, maybe. That's what they might say, you know. But you're looking at the relevant interest rather than an interest they possibly can't have. You know, so things like, in terms of rights, that would be like voting, driving cars.
Right.
So that's when we talk about rights. I assume it's the same for interests, really. You're looking at what possible interests could sentient being have. And then adding them into your equations, you know, as kind of an equal input into that equation. It might still come out as not, you know, waiting on the other side more. But at least you've taken it into account. It's trying to be non-prejudicial as well, which is a good feature of utilitarianism, I think.
I like so that. Okay.
The utility in utilitarianism means well-being, really. So that can be the good, the happiness, the pleasure, and then to prevent the opposite, really. So preventing the bad, the unhappiness and suffering, that type of thing. So classical utilitarianism seeks to maximize that utility, which means that well-being. So maximizing the good of all kind of interested parties, really.
This is like almost like natural law, where to the daisy, the water and sunshine are good. And yeah, because of the well-being of the daisy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So utilitarianism is about like the well-being of the entity or the agent. What would you call these in the?
I think they would say maybe sentient beings, because they were kind of one of the first to kind of introduce that idea as well. That, you know, like with Jeremy Bentham, it applies to kind of all creatures capable of sensation, really, that type of thing. And that what's morally relevant is, you know, we would say being sentient, but he might have said having the capacity for sensation. So you know, it applies to them, not just to humans, but to any being that could have that capacity, really.
Okay.
So yeah, you said about negative things. So negative utilitarianism would concentrate on minimizing that amount of aggregate suffering, or minimize suffering first as a priority, then look into maximizing happiness, which, you know, to me, I think you give more weight to suffering than you do to someone's happiness.
Well, yeah, so that's like the Schopenhauer idea of comparing the animal eating to the animal being eaten. Suffering outweighs joy, right? There's always the animal being eaten. It's his last moments on earth. It's the worst thing that could possibly happen. You know, screaming and going out the worst way possible. And to the hyena doing the killing, it's just another day, just another meal. But the experiencing joy, right? So suffering outweighing joy, I think, is pretty commonplace in philosophical terms, right?
Yeah, kind of. I think the you'd call it like an asymmetry principle, that you give more weight to suffering than you do to, you know, just increasing people who are already at a certain level of welfare or well-being. It shouldn't, you know, you should look to the poor first, really, to bring them up to a level, rather than making people that are already kind of, you know, quite happy, just making them more happy isn't really the priority there. So that's one, that would have been a criticism of utilitarianism. And then they would have brought in this thing to say, well, we are going to concentrate on eliminating suffering first, you know.
Mm-hmm. I like that too, because I think that's kind of what like the Western idea of free nations are. It's like this idea that you have the freedom from oppression, right? You have the freedom from these. It's not really the freedom to do things. There are very few things for
negative rights.
Free. Yeah.
Freedom from. Like, I don't have to follow your religion. You know, I've got freedom of religion. It's also practice. Yeah, freedom not to be forced to practice religion.
Totally.
And that type of thing, you know, so yeah.
Right, freedom from political persecution or whatever, religious persecution is kind of what the hallmarks of like Magna Carta style democracies, I guess. I don't know, like
they'd be negative rights, and then I suppose positive rights would then be, you know, you've got a right to
vote,
healthcare, votes, that type of thing.
Yeah,
positive rights. But I think. So the negative utilitarianism can deal with some of the classical utilitarianism problems. But I think that's why they kind of introduced that. Then I've got rule utilitarianism. Yeah.
Roger wants to say negative utilitarians want to stop lions from eating flesh.
So, that would be about, you know, eliminating suffering. I think that's where the misconceptions about, say, a vegan is a negative utilitarian, then they might go on to incorporate wild animal suffering, which I think is something we, you know, can discuss and think about. But whether that is it within the scope of veganism as we kind of understand it, you know,
maybe you hear about that a lot, right?
This
idea, I've heard that so much about like how we're trying to eliminate suffering in the wild, and I just can't. Yeah. I get off pretty quickly where I'm like, I don't look, I don't want anything. I'm really of the ilk of just leave them alone. Let nature take its course and just stay out of it as much as possible. You know, let's keep our technocrats out of the forest and let the lions do what they need to do.
Yeah. You know? I think the Animal Ethics website, which I think is good as well, they've got the section on veganism, which is, you know, about exploiting and commodifying animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've got the section on kind of wild animal suffering as well, you know, so kind of treating them separately. And then some of the discussions I've been having on Twitter recently as well is about defining veganism. So, you know, people saying it should just incorporate all sentient beings.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think there's an argument for that. And if we discover, you know, more sentient beings, then I think, we should be sentientists anyway. You know, and then I think we're just concentrating with veganism, we're concentrating on animals because that's what we have here.
Yeah.
That's what's in front of us at the moment, and that's what we're dealing with, so
right. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, we don't have alien life form falling from the sky just yet. You know, like I remember reading about vegetarianism and whether or not, like, if you went to a foreign planet, how would you determine what to eat and what to not eat? And then it came to like, well, okay, then for a meat eater, a carny, what would a carny do on the same planet, and what traits make the humanity, like if you encounter an alien species, what makes it human enough that you don't kill it and eat it, or him? Should I say him? It's an alien. Am I allowed to call aliens it? The hypothetical aliens. Let's hear if Roger allows me to say it on that. But him, like if you encounter an alien species and it's human like, will you eat him? And then where do you draw the line when it comes to animals? And then where does the vegetarian draw the line? And I think like it becomes a much clearer line that way. It's interesting to me that
I think that shows that human isn't the, you know, the morally relevant category then as well, you know, because there could be alien life forms that qualify for rights and moral status, you know, and the same with artificial intelligence. We just haven't got that knowledge yet, but some of the discussions on Twitter were just about kind of future proofing in case we come across those things.
Yeah,
you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson might say, like, sentient alien plants. So
yeah,
if we come across them, fine, you know, we'll
fine, then I won't eat those either.
Incorporate them.
I'll protect them. I will defend their rights.
We'll sentient just eat the plants.
Yeah. Perfectly willing to do that, Mr. deGrasse Tyson, you speciesist bastard. So like the It's interesting because I remember reading that in, it was in reference to, it was an essay on abortion, actually, which how they were, what they were doing was where does the human come out? Mm-hmm. So if you're saying that abortion is killing a human, which is often oftentimes the argument, right? Well, then where is that line? How do you draw that line? Where do you draw that line? And even when you came to like a, between a fetus and an animal that you're likely, more likely than not, to kill for food, is the fetus more like that? And then if no, actually it isn't, so what would it be more like? And so you kind of go down this this gradation of sentience, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting one whether, you know, the sentience is kind of scalar or kind of an on-off, you know. I think, and when it does come to those kind of grey areas, I don't, you know, I don't think the sentience, kind of, it's kind of compared to a dimmer switch as well. Does the sentience increase as you kind of go up that evolutionary scale, you know? Or is there just, you know, it's a minimal kind of threshold for moral status, which means that should be given, you know, that weight for consideration anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think you'd have a hard time arguing that, you know, humans aren't more sentient than, say, an oyster, you know.
Than an oyster, yeah. Yeah, I mean, when you're taking the extremes, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and then you have
ends, you know.
Yeah, and then you have the idea, again, the Schopenhauer idea that the sounding board of language making our suffering more complex. Mm. I mean, a human being sitting in a room alone can be suffering, and it doesn't make any sense to anyone outside the room that that person's suffering. And you couldn't say, you probably couldn't say the same thing about a dog sitting in a room thinking about its problems, his problems, god damn it. His or her problems, said the dog. Yeah, I don't know. I think that negative utilitarian may say that we should use our godlike powers to manage every square meter of the planet and end all animal suffering. I've heard that stuff before, but I think it's ridiculous. Just discovered the animal ethics site. Looks good. Okay, good. Star Trek often dealt with sentient alien others, perhaps most especially in The Next Generation. Yeah, they did. And it was interesting about, you know, I always love that type of stuff because the idea of desire to, like the desire to be hunted. I mean, there's species in Star Trek that that's their purpose in life. They want to be hunted.
Yeah. It
depends on which human and which oyster. It does.
Mm-hmm. I think we might have said it before though, with Star Trek and a lot of sci-fi, they're kind of, you know, too lenient use of sentience, or might be too restrictive actually, of sentience, whereas we understand it as meaning, you know, animals as well, and even on an alien planet we would assume it would be like the kind of beings that had evolved there, you know, with similar traits we'd take as being sentient. But on Star Trek and a lot of sci-fi, they just say the humanoid species are the ones that are sentient, yeah. And that even the animals that are alien, they say aren't sentient. So, but to me, that's more sapience, you know.
Yeah, I guess they don't really say less sentient. They'll say lower life forms, which is offensive in its own right, right? They'll say lower. They'll say humanoids and lower life forms. But they'll have non-humanoid, non-humanoid sentient life too. So it's interesting. They'll have, you know, AI, that, like, that's a big thing about AI.
Yeah.
Like they've covered that several times about what is sentient.
With data, I think it depends on the writer as well, because it was all different writers for different episodes. You would have Riker saying, you know, we no longer enslave animals for food purposes in one episode, and then the next episode there, you might be eating some gawk or something, you know.
Right, some gawk.
So... So it's just the different writers. We, you know, if they all were going from the same playbook that Star Trek should respect all sentient beings, then they'd all be on board with it, you know, and there'd be a bit of unity there. But because it was all these different writers, you're getting different value systems basically all put together, you know?
Well, this is the problem with like fanboy canonical studies, right? It's supposed to be fun and make you think. And I feel that same way with comic books. Like, I've said this a ton of times on the show that Superman is vegan. Superman isn't always vegan. Superman on TV sometimes goes to barbecues and eats hamburgers, but in the comic books, most of the time he's considered vegetarian or vegan. Batman on many times have been convinced to go vegan by Robin, who was vegan because Batman told him that killing was wrong. So it's like, these are, we call them runs in comic books. We call them episodes or in, you know, story arcs or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, different writers do different things. It's not going to be. And also these things, I don't know. I always despise the preciousness of it all. Like Star Wars being so precious. Like, no, we can't, we can't touch it. We can't, no, it's perfect. Then don't touch it. Then don't do anything with it. Like either get ballsy with it or leave it alone. Put it in a museum. Because that's probably where it belongs anyway, is in a museum.
Yeah.
Star Trek. Yeah, I don't think. Unless you're going to make a Jar Jar movie. If you're going to make a Jar Jar show, then I don't want to. Like, something.
I think they should have just gone all out and just gone for a total Jar Jar, Darth Jar Jar.
Yes.
Theory. You should have just done it.
Why couldn't they? Like, they get adventurous with this stuff. You know, I love this stuff. Like, then people might get interested and do. But instead, they want to do fanboy service because it's all so precious. Everything is so important. The timeline can't be disturbed and all of these things. But it's like, dude, it was already disturbed in the first three movies. Stop. Like, yeah. I hate anything that becomes so precious. It's like punk rock being in a museum. I went to a museum with where Henry Rollins was the DJ on the opening night, and it was art from punk rock and go-go from the DC, because DC was kind of known for like go-go and punk rock. And you know, it was great. They had, someone had kept what a collection of all of these posters from all of these punk shows over the years. But it's like, is this what we've become? This is punk rock now? We're in a museum? Cool.
Yeah, I think anything like that, you start having to look for what's the alternative in other places. You know, kind of these things get ossified and kind of obviously commercialized. Yeah. And then you start having to look at, like, you know, where's the new club that's got the new music then, you know, and who are the ones actually rebelling then, you know?
Yeah, I just feel, at least with music, you're right. There's always some new music coming out. And in that vein, even you cannot commodify a genre to the point where Disney can't own punk rock, right? But Disney can own, I don't know, Disney can own Captain America. I mean, how much cooler would it be if Captain America passed into public domain and anybody can make a Captain America, like Robin Hood? Like, if you wanted to make a Robin Hood movie tomorrow, you could. Like, that's where Captain America should be. And we could make really cool ones or really shitty ones. We'll see. Who cares? Get adventurous. Do interesting things. I mean, like, that would be so much more. I don't know. I have such high hopes for humanity. And then with this, like, everything becoming so precious and like kept behind in some boardroom with behind under stacks of paper from IP lawyers. They you can't touch Jar Jar. We own Jar Jar. Do something.
they should definitely let Jar Jar go.
Let Jar Jar go.
Do whatever they want.
Yes. Sell Jar Jar to Sony.
Those fun films. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, Disney bought Sony, so that won't fly anymore. I don't know. Like, that's the other thing. Disney owns all of it. So now, like you can't do anything with all of these great characters that nobody should own, but for some reason Disney owns. They didn't make these characters. They bought them. Anyway.
But let's not forget, Jar Jar is sentient, and we should respect him.
Yes, Jar Jar is sentient, and we should respect him. Although he might be a plant, for all I know. He could be a plant, like Neil deGrasse Tyson, a sentient plant. Beast Boy doesn't eat animals because he turns into them. It's true. Animal Man doesn't either. Oh, he's mentioned Animal Man is one of my favorites. Yeah. Grant Morrison. Grant Morrison wrote the most famous Animal Man run, and he's also the one who made Superman vegan. Same writer.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Need to look at those, yeah. There were some vegan comics coming out years ago, because there was, I think, one called Earthling or something. And, you know, all vegan artists working on them. And I think Patrick Baboumian as well was starring in one.
That vegan, of course, could be like something where it becomes a vegan media company, where it's like, made with, because, you know, I realize there's like
AWP, vegans for vegans.
Right. Yeah. FBV, FF, for us, by us. I made a logo. It's FVBV, for vegans, by vegans. All my VFFs, all my vegan friends forever are here. Grant goes, you know, like, I would love to have, like, if we could have a vegan media company where we can make our own comics if we wanted to. I mean, it's all digital now anyway. Like, we could find vegan artists and create something under the same umbrella. I mean, I think that the world needs it. Instead, we're making political parties. Like, that's doesn't make sense to me. Like, in England, what's the one that Saffron Gloin belongs to? Is it AWP, Animal Welfare Party? Is that what it's called? I think it's called AWP.
Might be, yeah. Not sure.
Yeah, and they have.
I've heard of the Animal Welfare Party, though. Yeah,
but it's a political party, right? And I.
Yeah.
And they're.
I thought they were more Australian, actually, or New Zealand's. Well,
maybe, but Saffron's definitely in England. That girl talk like she's from England. And she know she from. Yeah. She's definitely from England, mate. She's one of them you might meet at the club. You know what I mean? Yeah, she's awesome, and I love her. She's COVID, by the way. She had to be on a ventilator. I haven't heard about that happening for a while. She seems okay, but like I can't think of something. Starting a party is cool and all, but like, haven't we been doing that for a long time? Isn't the answer really in media? Isn't that really where we're gonna make headway?
There was a good channel. It might be defunct now. What was it called? The Onion Knight was really good. And I think they'd modeled themselves on the Young Turks kind of channel.
Well, The Onion. Yeah. It's a famous newspaper here, The Onion.
Yeah. So they were The Onion Knight, this was called. So it was a vegan channel. And they were trying to model themselves on that, though, saying we will be like the vegan version of the Young Turks, you know.
Yeah, I love that.
Have that news and kind of what the stories that are of interest to vegans. And I thought that was really promising, but I don't think it didn't get enough views. I don't think, you know.
Because you can't do it with one show. Just like I couldn't do it with just this one show. Like, it would have to grow and have many shows. It would have to have a lot of different voices. And you'd have to be like, okay, well, Sky isn't really my cup of tea. But... But right after Sky's show comes on this other dude that I'm really into, or woman that has an amazing presence and speaks to me. And maybe there's the gaming channel. Like I watched a lot of live streams this weekend, vegan live streams, and they all have different flavors of the same thing, which is exactly what's happening on things like CNN or whatever. But instead of like conglomerating it and actually doing something, we're all scattered about as these like, influencers trying to like make money on YouTube, I guess is what the game is.
Yeah. There's a lot of it's kind of provoking debates and then monetizing them as well. I've noticed a lot. So kind of picking these points of contention and then, you know, having basically a debate channel, and that's what people's income stream is. Where instead of, you know, it's kind of that's a heuristic, you know, which is argumentative. But I think what I prefer is, you know, if I'm wrong about something, try and show me and try and help me, and let's work as a collective to get a better definition, or let's work as a collective to get better arguments against anti-vegan arguments. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, I probably used to be a bit heuristic myself. You know, I'm speaking as an older person now, looking back on my younger arguments.
Older person, yes. You and old
man. I could have a monetized channel where I'm picking on these anti-vegans and saying how foolish they are and everything. But, you know, I think now I want vegans to be armed with good arguments and the strongest arguments they can have, and for, you know, our arguments to be persuasive and credible and that type of thing. But it's not, you know, it's not about me kind of thing, you know, he says humbly. It's about like getting these arguments, because I'm interested in the truth and getting the good argument, you know.
Well, that's why,
so
I think
for me, that it's not about like Benny Malone owns so-and-so or destroys so-and-so.
No, and I think that's why people always concentrate on those, like the Tucker Carlson's or these types of characters doing these things on Fox News, right?
Yeah.
But that is one part of their multi-pronged attack on culture. They have also news, where it's just people talking about news and ideas, and even some content that they don't make. They just show edited content that their viewers might like. And so, like, someone just brought up Water Bear, right? The Water Bear Network has a lot of vegan docs. What I'm saying, a vegan network, a vegan media company would still show that between. And then maybe there's like, okay, there's the morning show guy, and he does like a magazine show, interviews all these people. And then there's an hour of doc that we watch that we just get permission to. It's just licensing. Most of those things are so cheap to license. You just show it. And then you then the next person comes on. It's Benny Malone talking about how to win arguments with the non-vegans and talk about how to get suss out the truth about what's really causing this. And then,
well,
after that,
I think it'd be everyone's different strengths as well, you know, because everyone's bringing something different to the movement. So,
and then we have our Tucker Carlson, who's on it during primetime, who shouts at non-vegans and has debates. Yeah. Great.
Yeah. Like, what I think, you know, my area is kind of analyzing arguments. So that's what I try and do. Someone presents an argument, I'll try and analyze it, say, well, this is what they're doing with that argument. And then what's either the facts about that, or is that a reasonable argument? You know, and that's the way I try and look at it. But obviously, I can't cover everything. I can't give people, you know, people say, oh, you should just be doing recipes, or just show people that you're healthy and fit and that, and they want to get rid of that part of what I do, you know, and that's eliminating what I think I'm good at. And, you know,
totally, whereas I think,
you know, if you want the health advice and the nutrition, you're better off watching Monday with Nelsie, you know.
Yes.
Whereas asking me about that is not good, you know. I know
Roger says the same thing. Roger's not into nutrition, right? He's not like, and if you want to know about
experts, basically, you know,
totally. And I think it shows that we're. I think one of the dangers we have with these kind of columns that we have in the vegan movement is that everyone's got their own channel. No one's doing like, because there's about Ronnie's talking about organizing, and I'm like, okay, well. Am I organizing? I mean, I've got five vegans on every week, and we're kind of creating a voice for my whole idea was
building,
to hear community, which is organizing, isn't it? Isn't that the same thing?
Yeah,
I think. I mean, but the idea was to say that, well, look at these vegans. We all have different voices, and they're all important. Mm-hmm. And there might be nuance in there that we disagree. By the way, which is where I think nice little conflicts can arise. Yeah. I love it, but not everyone's going to be Nelsie, who's like super energetic and like nutrition and knows about this stuff. And not everyone's going to be, I don't know, vegan SOBs, where they're talking about pop culture and their experiences with how animals are used on sets, you know, like, because when they were telling
the culture kind of aspect of it, which is what you're saying about comics and getting ideas into media and comics. But it's a total joke. The mainstream media, the way, like I was saying with the poison in the well, the way we just basically get set up. It's why I would never be confident going on a show, because I know I'm just getting set up, basically. You know, and that's why where I do think Earthling Ed and them are better suited to that than I would be, you know. And the appearance on with Trevor Noah when
Ryuji,
was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Went on and that, you know. I'd just be like, "Well, you're setting me up here, you know." But I don't think I'd be good on it.
Well, you're going into the lion's den. You're going into the into their house where all the cards are stacked against you, and they live there, and you're supposed to go in there with just as much swagger as they do, and try to compete with them. They've got home field advantage in a way that's like way more extreme than what you find in sports.
And I think with the James Whale thing, in the end, they just appeal to ridicule anyway. No matter
that's
what,
exactly what they
the
did.
End, the end, they just finish with appeal to ridicule anyway. And
get something you're stupid, and I'm going to spend the rest of my day. Yeah.
So you can't really win. And you kind of set up for catch 22 questions as well. You know, like, do you want to ban everyone from having a choice then? And, you know, yes or no. It's like, well, it's not really a yes or no. And then you can't explain yourself properly, you know.
Right or wrong. Yeah, that's like the right or wrong. That's like a really shitty management style. Like that's something that it's a tactic in management. Like this is how we do it, right or wrong. And it's like it presents the worker with this like, okay, well you're right. Like what are you like, because they're in a situation of hierarchy where you have you have the reasonable demand to have an answer and they have the reasonable expectation to give you one. So for you to pose the question in such a way is a trick to get people to do what you want once you learn that trick, you can use it in like really fast paced environments where you're like, okay, this and this need to be done, right or wrong. Yeah. Okay. You're right, boss. Okay. And then on to the next one.
Yeah.
But it is cheating. It is like the worst, and it doesn't feel good for either person involved. No, you have to almost
when you're on the receiving end of something like that, you know, if you're on the receiving end of like a gish gallop or something, it just doesn't feel good, or you feel you're getting trapped and that type of thing. Yeah.
Well, and reasonable people would apologize afterwards, which is that's something I always loved about hospitality. When it's really busy and at the end, you might have been screaming at the chef and screaming at the like all this. I was never much of a screamer, but I definitely was quite sharp, pointed. But at the end, I'd be like, guys, you know, thank you so much. You know, sorry about it if I came off as rushed, but you know, we were in that mode of transaction. Da, 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 da. And then they're all friends, you know. Then you have to do that though, because you've done so much damage in the course of business. They aren't doing that. They aren't doing that part. It's like they learn all these shitty management tricks and argument tricks, and then they don't do the second part.
Yeah. And it's just so one-sided, you know, if they could ask a question, then you could ask a question.
Right.
You know, so, okay, then what is your, you know, criterion for moral status to animals, you know, and if then see what they say, you know, but it tends to just be one-sided.
Well, what question? It's hard too when someone goes, okay, what question do you have for me? And you put them on the spot. It's hard to, because it's almost like that game where you're trying to push someone out of the circle, because you just have to keep them off balance long enough that they can't really have. So you never get to the truth. Is what you were saying before.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to push you so far off your game that we can't get to the truth. I want to actually like have
conversations. Yeah, I saw a good framework. I might bring it up another time with the different styles of arguments. You know, heuristic was one of them, you know, which is just to try and win the argument, basically. But then others, you know, I prefer that kind of collective effort to get to the truth or to get to a solution, you know. So,
yeah,
I think I'll probably just get through the utilitarian bit now anyway, which is fine, you know. But the next bit was... You know, if I had to be a utilitarian, maybe I would be maybe a two-level utilitarian, maybe.
A two-level.
Yeah. So, but before that, I'll go to rule utilitarianism. So the right in that is to conform to a rule that leads to the greatest good. So you're looking at the correctness of the rule then. So you would start using kind of heuristics and shorthands to say, well, this is the right thing to do in that situation, rather than having to do a calculation every time. So in utilitarianism, they'll talk about doing that balance and that calculation every time. You know, what's the positives and the negatives of acting in that way, or what are the consequences? Because it's a consequentialist theory as well. Yeah, the main part of it is, what are the outcomes of these actions? It doesn't mean they disregard everything else, but being consequentialist means consequences are the main thing, you know.
It's funny you say that, and like I just saw, because you bring up a term, heuristic, and I'm like, it's funny because I used to say heuristic.
I don't actually know, is it heuristic or heuristic?
I don't know. I always said
I
heuristic.
Think it's heuristic.
I said heuristic. We had a heuristic we had the, like, you know how in Harvard they have the National Lampoon, or they have the Harvard Lampoon, which became the National Lampoon, which is how we get movies like Caddyshack. So it was a magazine from Harvard that was like taking the piss, basically. We have one at Berkeley called heuristic squelch. Heuristic squelch is what it's called. But it's funny, like, how many people know what heuristic or heuristic is? Mm-hmm. Heuristic sounds like, because isn't you like euthanasia? You is good, right?
Mm. Well, it is H-E-U though, isn't it?
Right, H-E-U, yeah.
So I'm not sure. Well, just basically a rule of thumb, you could say as well, you know. So instead of having to calculate everything every time, you go by a rule. So the general rule, even though it's utilitarian, will be, well, a general rule not to steal, a general rule not to lie, that type of thing, you know, will have the best outcome. But then obviously there's going to be exceptions. And that brings us on to kind of ACT utilitarianism, which concentrates more on the right being to produce the best results in that specific situation. So you'd be concentrating on, will lying in that specific situation actually bring the best outcome? So an example of that usually brought up is like, you know, say Anne Frank is hiding in your basement and the Nazis come knocking. Do you lie to say she's not there, you know? If you lie, you're breaking like a deontological rule against lying, which I think most people would say it's okay to lie, though, you know, to send the Nazis away.
So right, it's okay.
That could kind of bring us onto like a threshold deontology as well, where you think the outcome of lying isn't, you know, is the best outcome.
The ends justify the means.
Yeah, the ends justify the means, which is utilitarianism, basically. So for me, I kind of came up with my own ethical thing before I knew what threshold deontology was. I think I kind of was approaching it anyway, where I used to say, well, I'm a deontologist following these kind of rules until I kind of come to a point where I'll become a utilitarian if I think the outcomes are just going to be so bad. And then when I was learning more about things, it turns out that's kind of what threshold deontology is. You follow deontology until the outcomes would be so dire, like, say, killing 1,000 people resulting from you following that rule, like never lying, you know, being your rule.
Well, yeah, it's like your Caligula, the Caligula, torture and kill one person or I'll kill 1,000. Then your rule becomes less important as the stakes go up, I guess. As the stakes increase, your rule becomes less concrete, doesn't it? Interesting.
I think they kind of blend there together as well, you know, even though they don't exactly match this kind of two-level utilitarianism that we'll come on to now. It kind of matches up a little bit with the threshold deontology. So you start with deontology, then going into kind of, I thought it's going into utilitarianism really, but it's kind of going into consequentialism. Starting with utilitarianism and then going into having rules, you know, for a lot of the time. So the two level comes from a philosopher called R.M. Hare, who I think was Peter Singer's kind of overseer at Oxford, I think it was. So quite influential there on Singer. And I'm not sure about Singer actually. But two level is using moral rules, except in rare situations where it's more appropriate to engage in a critical level of reasoning. So following the rule of thumb until you think, well, actually, I need to calculate this a bit more here. So I'm not sure the rule of thumb will always apply. So I'm going to calculate it a bit more and look into it more, which I think is reasonable as well. Yeah. So I think that's kind of like where they mirror each other, the deontological and utilitarian there. But then I think we start to get into some problems with utilitarianism when we come to average utilitarianism, which is maximizing an average amount of utility. There's also total utility. So averaging means it's population ethics we're getting into now, basically.
Right.
So imagine taking a population and averaging the kind of well-being of everyone and coming up with a figure for that population. This is where we start to get into these problems that a lot of people highlighted. You kind of have, I think it's the mere addition paradox, There's a paradox of hedonism and utility monsters. Those type of problems. I won't go into them now. But I think there's just a problem with averaging, because it's kind of something Richard Rider said as well. And he's the professor that came up with the term speciesism. He says, you know, this idea of well-being doesn't go beyond the individual. The individual is kind of the boundary of well-being, and it's not possible to average kind of utility amongst the population in that way.
Yeah. It's hard though when you're talking about like the future. I mean, this is something that or race politics. I mean, these things where, for example, this term in the Supreme Court term, we're going to be talking about maybe getting rid of affirmative action, making race a determining factor in college admissions, because on average, more people in a race who go to a prestigious university, the whole race will become on average better off, right? The more people who go to. So, I mean, that's an average utilitarian argument. But I mean, it's really difficult, because then it's like, well, what about the white kid who goes to studies every day and he doesn't get to go to class? He doesn't get to go to that school because of this policy, because back to the individual, right? Well, because we're trying to increase the average well-being of an entire race of people. It's really difficult to compare that to the singular, the individual.
Yeah. So I think it's treating the group as if they were an individual that experiences.
Right. Yeah.
That's what a lot of the criticism is, really. It's like treating the group as if that was the individual that experiences the utility of the group. And the criticism is that there is no such being that experiences that total or average utility. And that's where a lot of the criticisms of those come from.
I can't wait till the Supreme Court comes out with their decision on it, because no matter what happens, I really like reading their decisions, because they really do get into some of the stuff we're talking about when it comes to philosophy and like really looking at ethics and, you know, these it's fascinating. And I a lot of times in ethics courses they'll read Supreme Court decisions because of the way it's well thought out. It's written by, you know, constitutional scholars and that type of person. So it's no matter what, it's usually interesting, at least, you know.
It's really good to look at the way they structure the arguments.
Yes.
Build them up, and then you have that kind of preamble, and then getting into.
Totally.
I think they quite a good statement recently, the Montreal kind of declaration, for kind of animal rights almost that. So today on Twitter, you know, and the way that's worded, I thought was quite good. But if people go on Gary Francione's website as well, he's said he wasn't one of the signatories to it because he has some objections to it. I thought it was quite good though. But maybe we'll cover that some other time anyway.
Yeah, I think they were talking about that on the Animal Rights Show briefly yesterday.
Ah, right, yeah. I didn't see it until today, so I'll have to catch up on that, the Animal Rights Show, if they talk about it.
It's a good episode, yeah.
I agree.
Anything with Ronnie and Roger talking, I mean, that's always going to be a good time. Guys, make sure you check out our merch over on the Etsy store. It's etsy.com/slopsasvegan. Of course, I made some leggings yesterday that have the pockets say Carney Tears on them. They're like ladies' leggings, and they've got the V, the vegan V with the circle, you know, up and down the legs in a pattern. But the pockets say Carney Tears. I think that's pretty funny because you could keep Carney Tears in your pockets. I also have a tote bag that says Carney Tears, because you can keep Carney Tears in a tote bag. What do you think? We're 20 minutes past. What do you think? Benny and the Jets. Are we rounding the bend, or do you want to pick up the next time, or what's your plan?
I've got a couple more on the utilitarianism, then that'll just box that off.
Okay, let's do it. Let's do it.
We will have done utilitarianism then, and then next week I'll do maybe the do that interactive questionnaire, and we'll find out what everyone's meta ethics are.
I like it. Okay, then next time we'll do the questionnaire. All right. So let's get it. We got
pen
two
and paper ready. Okay. Preference utilitarianism. So that values actions that fulfill the most personal interests. So in terms of those population ethics, that would be looking at, each individual's personal interests more. So maybe that could even accommodate rights. You know, I have seen some utilitarian frameworks, like one of my friends that I talked to on Twitter and used to talk to on Facebook, Jeff Sebo. He's a utilitarian, but he's found a way to kind of incorporate rights within that framework, you know. So I kind of quite like that, you know. And yeah. He would, you know, if incorporating rights, he's still consequentialist, I think, you know, but if incorporating rights brings out the best outcomes, he thinks that's valid, you know. So I'm kind of with that, you know. So that's
we're back to like governments. That's how government works, right? Everything is utilitarian, except that your rights are protected. Like, it's like, we're going to be utilitarians about most things, but you have rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're making the rules as well, the laws, because you think that brings out the best outcomes as well, you know, and the best ways for us to live peaceably amongst each other, you know,
right?
Which is or the social contract or that type of thing. You're doing these rules because you think it has the best consequences anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think you can get to veganism from any of the ethical theories, but I just have my doubts whether you arrive, you know, specifically at like a position of not wanting to commodify and exploit sometimes. Because I just think with utilitarians, sometimes they might not be against the entire idea of commodifying. So I think they need to add a few things, maybe, you know,
exclude back to rights, commodifying
and exploiting, they need to include the rights maybe somehow. I've talked a bit about the average already. So you're taking the average of the population rather than, you know, so I've even seen it, you know, a single person could have 100 units of this utility, and that would be preferable to 1 million people with 99 units of this utility, which doesn't seem right to us really, which is why, you know, taken to that kind of level, the average utilitarianism doesn't really seem right. You know, is it better for one person, just one person existing who has, you know, really good utility, or 1 million people to have 99 units of utility? And I think most people would intuitively say it's better for 1 million people to have 99 units, you know, rather than one person.
Having 1 million, yeah. Yeah, okay.
Into, you know, a population kind of thing. And then total utilitarianism's applying the utilities to the group, adding each individual's utility together. And that can lead to the mere addition problem, where you have a large number of people with low individual utility. So you could have the population might have a high utility, but each individual member could actually have quite low utility. That's the problem with that. You know, say you've got a billion people with one unit of utility, but when you add up all the utility units, you know, they're saying, oh, it's great, it's a population with high utility. So that's the problem with that.
Yeah, it's a population with high utility because there's so many of them. So you get to like China, where it's so you get to China where there's so many of them that it seems like, oh, well, they're high utility, so it makes sense. That's, you know.
Yeah.
It's like where you go to, they had to dam up the Yangtze River and they displaced 8 million people, but there's a billion of them. So it's high. It's a utilitarian positive. Like we've actually given more people positive, but we displaced, I think it was 8 million people. I forget how. It was something ridiculous. Two different species of dolphin went extinct. It was a very horrible, But utilitarianism, you're right. Total utilitarianism.
Yeah. Actually, I think Singer is a preference utilitarianism.
A preference?
Utilitarianism. So I'm not sure if that's kind of within the two level, maybe, or that kind of one where we were saying where you'd maximize the well-being of, or like concentrate on suffering first to avoid these problems that we've just said about the kind of population ethics, you know.
Why doesn't Singer include rights, or does he?
He from what I've seen, he says he doesn't really believe in rights for humans or animals, but that's maybe because of his kind of meta-ethics, maybe. But I've seen him talk about rights, you know. I don't know, really.
It's funny.
He's not an animal rights advocate, basically. You know, the same way that, like, Tom Reagan and Francione are.
Right. Yes. He's a philosopher, and I think that he thinks about rights. I think that's, like, there's almost, with the words animal liberation and, like, mm-hmm. I think that there's a kind of a implication that he's thought about rights, but I don't think that he's really making an argument to...
Mm. If he did try to include them, it would be that consequentialist framework anyway, like I was saying with Jeff Sebo, if he did. Yeah. But I don't even think he does that. You know, I think he is just the maximizing happiness utilitarian view anyway. So he takes into account the suffering of sentient beings and takes, you know, every sentient being's interests into account. That would be what I think he would say, you know.
Yeah, Roger says that Singer talks about legal rights. Yeah, well,
all right,
yeah, legal rights. Yeah. Leave it to the Australian.
Mm, not moral rights, yeah.
That makes sense.
Right, so yeah. Not moral rights. Yeah, okay.
That makes sense, yeah. That sounds like Singer to me. All right, well, there was one...
So that's utilitarianism anyway, you know?
Right, well, he is kind of a utilitarian. I think, you know, I think there's... I think I took animal liberation off of my off of the show notes for this show because I don't know, because I think it's controversial enough that I think there's other books to read for vegans, and really I think that animal liberation is a book for people who are either thinking about going vegan or have things like that. I think most of the audience are already vegans, but I think that I won't apologize for defending Animal Liberation as an influential book for the movement, but I do see how problematic a lot of the things that he omits, how problematic that is for the movement. But it's a conversation starter, and I think it's a good conversation to start about the utilitarianism of animals. Yeah, you know, I forget who I was listening to yesterday.
Read it anyway, you know, to know what you're criticizing, if you're gonna criticize something anyway, you know. And
yeah,
you can't deny it was you know, influential, and the parts that you agree with obviously going to be, you know, still important. So yeah,
I mean, I remember reading it going, holy hell, I didn't know this type of thing was still happening. I didn't know. And I think it's funny when you talk to people about I think Roger was talking about it yesterday. It's like, you talk about vivisectionists and you're like, oh, that they're still doing this? And it's almost like right now Rand Paul's you know, his defense of his kind of bully pulpit speech about this new, I forget what the new law is called, but the law that just passed about modernizing our, not requiring medicines to be tested on animals as a matter of course. And saying that, like, it's been so long since we passed this law, like, nothing's changed. And it's still, like, I think a lot of people went, wait a second, what? We're still doing these things? And so I feel like animal liberation still does that, where it's like, knock, knock, this shit's happening on your doorstep with your, you know, and you're complicit. You're complicit in these acts.
Yeah.
So
I think eating animals as well, you know, if people don't know what is actually going on. So Roger's saying Singer's been called an ACT utilitarian, preference utilitarian, and the hedonistic utilitarian.
Yeah.
So it's quite hard to keep up.
He's been called lots of things. He's called lots of things. I mean, and rightly so. I think a lot of things, the fact that he doesn't consider himself a vegan bothers me. I'm afraid I'm some kind of utilitarian, glad there are different kinds, some of which are corporate rights. Well, Vegan Stallion, you're in luck, because you can grab a pen and paper next week, next Tuesday. We're going to go and we're going to find out what kind of utilitarians we all are. Did I say that right,
Benny? Well, not strictly. It's before that, really, because utilitarianism, the ontology they're the normative ethics, but we'll find out what comes before that, the meta-ethical framework, whether you believe moral claims are kind of truth apt, you know, do they say something real about the universe? Can they be true or false? That type of thing, which kind of comes before what your actual system is. So, I mean, you don't need, you know, you could have a system of ethics and not really ever really have to look at meta-ethics. You could always look at it briefly. But I think most people probably go through life never knowing what their ethical framework is, you know, really.
Yeah.
But next week we're going to find out for everyone here, you know.
What is your ethical framework? I like it.
Yeah.
Animal liberation was extremely influential by the start of the animal confusion movement, according to Gary Francione. Well, Francione. yeah, I mean, animal confusion movement. Okay, fair. I'm not arguing against that, but you got to have some idea. Like, I went vegan before reading Peter Singer, and I still felt that Peter Singer's book was, I don't know, it's definitely helped me frame kind of why I'm vegan and why, because if I'm vegan because I'm against violence and oppression, well, the things that he's talking about in his books are clear. You could kind of, it kind of starts you down a journey, which I think is valuable. All right, guys, to all of those who say real vegan streamers stream for 6 hours, well, the party's not over, guys. We have a Discord where I will be going to our vegan after party and talking about whatever you guys want.
Utilitarianism.
Exactly. Yes, egalitarianism, utilitarianism. Absolutely, that's what we're going to be talking about, and your meta ethical position, and how we ought to act. And we're also going to talk about the sites of Elmsmere Port. So that's our
Elsmere.
Damn it! I even wrote it down. Elsmere Port. Yeah, I wrote it down, so I wouldn't mess it up anymore. Elsmere Port and thought terminating cliches. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. If you have, please check out our shop on Amazon right now. There's a fun, there's this book that we just talked about with Benny's book is on there. Please go check it out. We also have trick-or-treating, vegan trick-or-treat list, stuff like that on our amazon.com/shop/vegan. Of course, we also have our Etsy shop, which I'm super proud of because I'm working very hard on it, trying to get some cool merch that says vegan stuff on it. So please check that out. It's etsy.com/shop/vegan. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter. It's Skyjack Morgan. Benny is readily available everywhere. He's also on Discord. And I think I put a link to his stuff in the show notes. Please see us next Tuesday, where we'll be talking about meta ethical positions. Right, Benny? Yeah. Meta ethical positions.
Yep. Pen and paper ready.
Cool. Get your pen and paper ready. We are going to have a little bit of study time. And tomorrow we have Roger Yates, the one and only Roger Yates, will be on the show. Thursday we have vegan SOBs. The goddamn vegan SOBs will be here on Thursday. It's kind of our pop culture day. Friday we have the one and only Patrice Jones will be joining us. So thank you everybody for joining us today. Am I forgetting anything? I hope not. If I am, maybe we'll catch up in Discord. Oh, the NFTs. We have awesome NFTs. It's something that I'm really stoked about. Vegans, I think, need to be in the Web3 space. So I think this is a really cool kind of gateway drug for you. And I will help you in any way I can to bring you into the Web3 space. We need to be there. And if you're a holder of the pumpkin, what do you call it? A Halloween project. If you're a holder of the jack-o'-lantern, you will be able to vote on which grassroots organizations get the money from the product, from the contract. So when you buy them, the money goes into a smart contract holder and will vote on where the money goes. That's pretty cool if you're a holder. And you can nominate too. You can nominate and vote on where the money goes. All right. Anything else, Benny?
No, that's it.
That's it? All right. Great, Benny. Thank you so much. That's it. All the way from Elsmere Port, the UK. Elsmere Port, the UK, and Southern Orange County, Southern California. Look at that. We're We're international. Bye, everybody. See you on Discord. I'm going to make some more carny tears and see you on Discord.
Okay, bye, everyone. Thanks, Sky.
Yeah, and don't be as afraid of utilitarianism. There's some good stuff in there. Look at all the different types of utilitarianism we discovered. You know, there's so many cool things we can do. Think about. It's about starting thoughts and having thoughts and conversations about these things. Bye. You know, it's